Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
The information depicted in this podcast is purely for informational purposes only. Please consult your healthcare professional before making any changes to your lifestyle or routine.
Hey everyone, and welcome to the Boost Your Biology podcast. My name is Lucas, and I am the founder of Ergogenic Health. Together in this podcast series, we will go underground to explore cutting-edge health and human performance insights that you simply cannot search on Google to help you upgrade your existence. So, without any further ado, let's jump into today's episode.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Boost Your Biology podcast. Today's prestigious and special guest is a neuropsychopharmacologist specializing in the research of drugs that affect the brain and conditions such as addiction, anxiety, and sleep. Professor David Nutt, welcome to the show.
Great to be here. Thank you.
So, David, maybe did you want to let my listeners know a little bit about, I guess, your journey and how you became so interested in the human brain?
Well, yeah, it goes back to childhood, really. When I started thinking about thinking, it kind of became clear to me that the brain's got quite a lot to do with it. Mm-hmm. And I went to university to do brain science, and then I changed to medicine because I realized that I was interested in human brains rather than fish brains or frog brains. So I became a doctor so I could more legitimately study human brains and also would do it from, you know, the perspective of a knowledge about illness. And then I became a psychiatrist because that was way the most interesting branch of medicine and obviously to do with the brain and also challenging because, you know, there's a lot of controversy in psychiatry. And I quite like to sort of be there, you know, where there's debate and dissent. And I spent the last 40 years doing research and treating patients.
Amazing, amazing. And so I guess for my listeners, a lot of our discussion today will be centered around different classes of drugs. So first of all, I'd love to start with defining psychedelics.
Yeah, well, that's quite a challenging thing. I mean, typically psychedelic, it's from the Greek, it means mind revealing. And obviously the classic psychedelics are drugs like magic mushrooms or DMT or LSD. But then drugs like ketamine and salvia, sometimes they're called psychedelics too. Even I've heard MDMA called psychedelic, although I'm not sure it really is. So so the core psychedelics are mushrooms, LSD, DMT, ayahuasca. But then drugs like ketamine and salvia do have some similarities in the sense that they disrupt consciousness and they produce altered states of consciousness. And MDMA, well, it's the therapeutically useful, but it's not hallucinogenic, but it has some overlap in terms of the therapeutic value with drugs like psilocybin.
Mm. So I guess then from the therapeutic use of some of these compounds, maybe I know that you know quite a lot on MDMA. So maybe did you want to share, where's the current research at with MDMA psychotherapy?
Yeah, well, it's at a very exciting juncture at present, because just a few months ago, the MAPS organization, which is this charity that was set up about 30 years ago by Rick Doblin to try to keep MDMA as a medicine, because it was a medicine until it got banned for recreational use. And they've just finished their phase, what we call the phase three, first phase three study. And that's a very important study. That's a placebo-controlled trial of MDMA in PTSD. And the results were very, very powerful. Very, you know, big effect size, twice as good as placebo, which is unusual in most mental illnesses, because placebo is quite powerful. So the great thing about it is there's only one more step they need now, one more of those trials, and it will become a medicine. So that trial's underway, and you know, fingers crossed, the end of the year, this year, it'll be published, and we might have it as a medicine in many countries, including yours, I hope.
So maybe, I guess, with a compound like MDMA, do we have an understanding as to its mechanism of action in terms of maybe facilitating the extinction of fear or helping with PTSD at all?
Well, I think you know the answer there. Yes, exactly right. So MDMA is a very interesting drug because it's an amphetamine-like drug, but it's very different from amphetamines. Amphetamines give you drive and energy, whereas MDMA gives you tranquility, insight. Originally, when it was discovered and was being used for psychotherapy by Shulgin and his wife, it was called empathy, because that's what it does. It really does produce empathy. Why it does that, we're not sure. There are theories. It's through serotonin release. It definitely releases serotonin, but it also... that serotonin release may then release oxytocin, which is a bonding hormone. It's the hormone that bonds people together after they've had sex, for instance. So, but anyway, whatever mechanism it is, it definitely produces a lot of empathy. But it also reduces anxiety, particularly negative anxiety and negative emotions. And it's that reducing emotions that allows people who've been traumatized, who have traumatic memories which come back, the emotions come back and disturb them. It allows them to go into therapy so that they can get mastery over these emotions and, as you said, extinguish them. Now, when I've been working in PTSD, I've written two books on PTSD, and I've been working in the field for 30 years. And one of the things we discovered really early on back in the 90s was that when people with PTSD, when you ask them to go back to where the trauma was, often the anxiety is so overwhelming. I mean, they would run out of the room or they'd faint. So you couldn't do therapy. Whereas MDMA seems to contain the emotion and allow them to keep their cognitions and keep their factual memories going. And so they can then talk about it and eventually overcome it through talking and have a sort of cognitive mastery over it as well as, you know, rather than just suppress it.
And so as part of that that stage three study you mentioned before, was it a combination of obviously drug therapy in combination?
Yes. Yeah. Very good. Absolutely, Lucas. Yes, it's really important to state this pretty much up front for all what we're talking about with psychedelics, MDMA. We see them as drug-facilitated psychotherapy or psychotherapy-facilitated drug treatment, but they work together, and that's the power of them. I mean, MDMA, we just discussed. It's classic. You use the MDMA to allow you to engage optimally in the therapy. And the therapy is what guides you back to where the trauma was, helps you think about it, and helps you restore your faith in life and people and yourself afterwards. So the psychotherapy is normally a course. Usually it's between about a 10 and a 14-week course. But interspersed in it are two or three sessions. In the MAPS trial, it was three sessions. We've just finished a trial and got it published of MDMA in alcoholism. Wow. People drinking to suppress stress and trauma. And there we had two sessions in an abstinence-based course. But so it's traditional psychotherapy helping people using, you know, to basically get more confidence, get mastery, get control of their lives. But we've put a couple of sessions of MDMA in so they can really grapple with the problem that caused them to have PTSD or that caused them to start drinking.
Interesting. So I guess there is also one particular pathway that I've noted has been activated or reconfigured by the use of some of these compounds, the default mode network. So maybe do you want to elaborate on that a little bit?
Sure. So the default mode network, it's called the default mode because it's the part of the, it's the network in the brain that is active when nothing else is happening. So we can activate it in you, in our listeners now. Well, all we need to do is just close your eyes. And when I stop talking, don't do anything. Just sit there with your eyes closed and reflect on what you plan to do later today. Right, let's do that. Okay, now open your eyes again. Now, when your eyes were closed and you weren't hearing anything, if we scanned your brain, the area of the brain that would be the network that would have been activated by the thinking about the future is called the default mode. It's active only when you're not doing other things. As soon as you open your eyes, it switches off because you're looking around. As soon as you hear something, it switches off because you're listening. As soon as you move, it switches off because you're doing things. But when you're in a state where you're just doing, thinking about yourself, it's the active network. And it's what's remarkable about it. It started off being discovered as the network which was there when you were doing nothing else. But it turns out from our work with psychedelics that it's the network which defines you, because psychedelics switch it off. And that's why you have these strange experiences, like you're floating into space, you know, you're visiting God, you know, you're seeing all these strange colored lights, because your brain has been liberated from the normal processes of control which the default mode network imposes on you.
Mm. And so some of the compounds that appear to manipulate that network, from what I'm aware, psilocybin is absolutely one of those, or perhaps it's
all the serotonin psychedelics, psilocybin, LSD, DMT, they all disrupt that network.
Wow. Okay. And so I guess as part of the research on psilocybin, maybe we can sort of segue and discuss a little bit on that. How much emphasis are you placing on that research, or how much time are you spending looking at what's happening there?
Well, that's my main research theme at present, my academic research. We've done the study showing how it worked. I think it's important for people to remember, I didn't start out working with psychedelics thinking I was going to have a new way of treating mental illness. I was just interested to know what the psychedelic state was. One of my claims to fame is I've given more drugs to different kinds of drugs to human beings than anyone else alive, probably. And the only class of drug I hadn't really studied up till now was psychedelics. And it was difficult because they were illegal and there was a lot of prejudice against them. But I got to them, when I got to that age, which was, well, about 55, I thought, well, you know, if you're going to do it now, you might not have time to do it. So started doing this research and discovered the amazing effects it had in the brain, switching off the brain, switching off the default mode, producing profound alterations in consciousness, but also dampening down the brain networks of depression, one of which is the default mode. And it was that discovery that you could dampen down the depression circuit that led us to write a grant to get a study to study psilocybin depression. Mm. And we took people with resistant depression. They'd all failed on one or two drugs. They'd all failed on more than two drugs. Some had failed on over 10 drugs. They'd all failed on CBT. And results were amazing. A single dose, 25 milligrams of psilocybin, produced the most powerful impact of any treatment ever in resistant depression. And that's led a company called Compass Pathways to go on and now do a proper trial of that with placebo. So that's where we started. And then we got interested in the whole question of, well, what other disorders do you know the default mode is abnormal in, and apart from depression? And there are quite a few. There's addictions, there's obsessive compulsive disorder, there's anorexia. And these are all disorders where people get locked into thinking, overthinking, thinking things which are wrong, but they can't escape from the thinking. It's like the brain has kind of taken over the mind. It's running a program which is not right, but you can't interrupt it. And what psychedelics seem to do is interrupt that program and allow the brain to kind of reset itself.
Mm.
And our patients, interestingly, when you depressed patients, we wrote a sort of detailed account of the experiences of many of them. And they often use this analogy. It's like, you know, their brain was out of control. They couldn't, it was doing its own thing. And then it was like a computer running away with a virus. And then the psilocybin kind of either defragged it or reset it or reformatted it, just got it all sorted out. And you know, often those effects can be very long, long lasting. Not in everyone, but in some people, they're cured still 8 years on.
Well, that's the other aspect I wanted to discuss is the somewhat semi-permanent effects of these compounds. What's the difference between these versus some of the current medications on the market?
Well, that is one of our key questions at present. So we can answer that in several different ways. So the first thing is the point you've just made is that a single dose of psilocybin can change people forever. I mean, you know, often people say, Steve Jobs said, you know, LSD, one of the five most important things in my life. You know, it probably helped him come up with the idea of a company, which is now the first trillion-dollar company, by fusing technology and art, you know, in the to make the beautiful machines like the one I'm talking to you from at present. So yeah, we know the enduring effects of psychedelics, but it turns out that in conditions like depression, yeah, you can have enduring effects. But even if you don't have enduring effects, you still have quite long-lasting effects from a single dose. Whereas traditional treatments, well, what are you doing? You're giving a dose every day, usually, for many months, or maybe even for years to protect people against relapse. So that's a different way of, different time course. So why is that? Well, the time course, we now have got a lot of, and again, since we started showing that psychedelics were interesting, a lot of preclinical researchers have gone back, you know, they've gone back to the test tube, they've gone back to the brain slice, and they've shown that psychedelics can promote the growth of new connections in the brain, new synapses, new synaptic spines. They're what we call plastogens. They increase plasticity, and it's likely that increase in plasticity, if it occurs in a circuit which is a good circuit, a circuit that keeps you well, can explain why the effects are long lasting, because you've actually changed the brain, you've put it back into a more normal state. But then the other question is, and this is what we haven't yet finally published, but we're working on, is that we actually think that they work in different parts of the brain. We're pretty confident from other people's work that SSRIs, traditional antidepressants, work in what we call the limbic system, the emotional circuit of the brain. And the analogy I look to use with these is a bit like if you break your leg, you put your bone in plaster of Paris to allow the bone to be stable so it can reset. You protect the bone against any more damage and it heals. And that's what antidepressants do in the limbic system. The limbic system is overactive. Chronic stress leads to overactive limbic system. That leads to depression. Antidepressants protect the limbic system. It's like they put a plaster around the limbic system, and over a period of weeks or months, it heals. And that's why these drugs take weeks or months to work, because it takes that long for the brain to heal. But what psychedelics do, psychedelics work in the higher part of the brain, the cortex, the most recently evolved part of the brain. And that's where the thinking is. That's where the thought processes are. These repetitive thoughts in depression, you know, I'm useless, I'm worthless, I shouldn't have done that, I've let everyone down, I'm going to kill myself because I don't have any value. Those repetitive loops, which destroy people effectively, limit their lives, they're disrupted by psychedelics because they're cortical loops and these drugs work in the cortex. So you break people out of these cortical loops and then they can, during the trip, they can kind of realize that the thinking's wrong, but they can also come up with new ways of thinking. And then that new way of thinking can be consolidated by the plasticity effect of the drug itself. So it's a double whammy, and that's why they're so powerful. They get rid of the old thinking and they help you reset the new.
Mm, makes sense. As far as the actual compounds themselves and perhaps maybe some of the metabolites, are we also skimming the surface in terms of what we know about, you know, psilocin and, you know, some maybe other metabolites and things like that?
Well, with magic mushrooms, xylosine is the active ingredient. The mushroom is very clever. It's quite sophisticated. So psilocybin is a prodrug. It's the active ingredient is xylosine, but the way xylosine is not very stable, so the mushroom sticks a great phosphate group onto xylosine to make psilocybin, and this phosphate group makes it very stable. It's like a salt. And then when you take it, the phosphate group gets flipped off, and then the active ingredient comes out and floats into your brain and does the business. Yeah. But, I mean, there are obviously many analogs of psilocybin that could be made, and companies are beginning to make them now. They all look a bit like serotonin. I mean, the difference between psilocin and serotonin is where one hydroxyl group is. In serotonin, it's a 5-hydroxyl, and in psilocin, it's a 4-hydroxyl. I mean, it's a tiny difference. They both work on the same receptor. It's just that what they do is slightly different, and we don't yet understand why psilocin is so much more powerful than serotonin.
Mm. And I'd imagine even with some of the newer releases of the ketamine derivatives like S-ketamine, maybe did you want to explain a bit about that?
Yeah, so ketamine is a very different kind of pharmacology. Ketamine is a blocker of glutamate receptors. And it's a bit complicated to explain, so I won't go into detail, but by blocking some glutamate receptors, ketamine liberates others, so the brain becomes hyperactive. And that also helps to overwrite or extinguish or rewrite or reformat memories, but it doesn't seem to produce the long-lasting changes that psilocybin does or LSD does. And that may be because those long-lasting changes have to be embedded in the receptors, the glutamate receptors that ketamine is actually blocking. But ketamine given twice a week over a period of time seems to lift mood and can in many people. Now, the thing about ketamine, it's an anesthetic. It's been around for 40-odd years. It's very safe, doesn't suppress respiration. Generally is injected IV or IM. But in psychiatry, psychiatrists, there are few of them like give injections. So what's S-ketamine is one of the two isomers of ketamine, which has been developed by Janssen as a treatment for depression. You take it intranasally, so you don't have to inject. And it can produce as a dissociative state. People need to be sitting somewhere safe and be looked after, attended to for an hour or so after it. And they can have it twice a week, usually for about 4 weeks, and then gradually once a week as the effect builds up. The one great advantage of ketamine, although you need to keep giving it, it does work even if you're on an SSRI. Mm. It's actually licensed for people who failed to fully respond to an SSRI. Now, psychedelics don't work if you're on an SSRI, because SSRIs somehow they block their effects, probably through changing the serotonin receptor.
Yeah, interesting. As far as, I guess, when it comes to, I know you're very well versed in terms of also understanding alcohol. Did you want to maybe, you know, how does alcohol fit into the whole picture here in terms of a drug?
Not an antidepressant. It is a depressant.
Yes.
But of course, it's the ultimate social drug, and it's been used by humans for millennia. There's this new theory, I don't know if you've come across this, the new theory that the foundation of what you might call agrarian human society, when humans morph from being nomadic to being settled, we used to think it was because of growing wheat, so people had to be there and tend the wheat. But now there are people saying, no, it wasn't growing wheat to eat, it was growing wheat or rice to make beer. And it was alcohol that actually changed the whole way of human life to becoming settled and sort of villagers as opposed to nomads. Anyway, so alcohol's been around a long time, but it's not a different receptor system. It, in low doses, it stimulates the GABA system, the inhibitory system in the brain. But at high doses, when you get to a state of blackout, you're actually doing a bit like ketamine does. You're actually blocking glutamate receptors, which is why you impair memory. But and then, of course, if eventually you block all the glutamate receptors, you stop breathing and die. But for most people, a gentle level of intoxication is due to turning on GABA, calming down your brain, a little bit of dopamine release gets you going a bit. The serotonin release makes you more sociable. It's a very complex drug, Argon, because it's a very small molecule and it fits into GABA receptors, glutamate receptors, and also has knock-on effects on dopamine and serotonin and endorphins. It releases endorphins too.
So I guess, does alcohol have any, do we know if it has any impact on that default mode network at all?
Yeah, well, strangely, we do. We get, although, isn't it amazing? The first proper MRI study of alcohol ever done, we did about 3 years ago. I mean, a drug which is used by 4 billion people worldwide has almost never been studied in terms of its brain act. But we were surprised the primary action actually was in limbic system more than the cortex, which we found, which is a bit surprising, really, given the fact that GABA receptors are particularly in the cortex. So we don't fully understand that. So categorically, it doesn't. I think in high doses it probably does when you forget where you are, and I don't think you ever forget who you are, but under alcohol, you often think you're better than you are, but. It has anything like as profound an effect on the default mode as the psychedelics. Now,
there is something that I've explored myself is, and I'm not sure if you've looked into it as well, is the phenomenon of the alcohol afterglow effect. Have you ever sort of looked into that at all?
You mean the next day?
The next day, people feeling significantly better.
Well, it's interesting you say that. Yeah, but some people don't. But you're right. No, I know this is a very important clinical. And I used to use this clinically. I used to use this. And I'll just share with you. I mean, this is completely, just clinical anecdote. But there, particularly people with bipolar disorder, I would find that would depress, particularly if they had the depressive aspect to that they often get a lot worse the next day after alcohol. And I would always caution them strongly because I think coming down from alcohol it's destabilizing to the nervous system, and some people get depressed. But as you say, some people get activated, and that's, we know why that is. That's noradrenaline. That's why people sleep gets disrupted. So if you go to bed drunk, you fall off to sleep very fast because you turn on the GABA system. It is dampened down your brain. You switch off. You go to sleep. And actually, interestingly, people often sleepwalk when they've got drunk. And that's because they dampen down their cortex so much that when they start walking, they don't wake up. Because you need the cortex to be awake. But then the adaptive responses in the brain often lead to disrupted sleep. So you typically wake up after 4 or 5 hours. And that's because you've got noradrenaline overdrive. And that noradrenaline overdrive can be energizing. I mean, it often can give you a headache as well, but tachycardia, heart can beat. But for some people, it can be energizing in the very same way as we often do sleep deprivation in people who are depressed to try to lift their mood. So, yes, yeah, so there's individual variation is quite high there. And, yeah, I mean, it's not something I would recommend as a treatment for people. But on the other hand, if you find, every now and then it benefits you, then, yeah, why not?
Well, it's interesting you also made that comparison between the alcohol and the sleep deprivation, because I personally, just sharing my own personal response, sometimes when I have a very, very late night, like maybe 3, 4, 5 a.m., and I get very minimal sleep, maybe 4 or 5 hours, that next day, sometimes my mental clarity is amazing. Like I have really good clarity of thought. It's really interesting.
It is, yeah. Well, I understand that. When I was a student, there were times when I felt a bit flat and under the weather and didn't have enough energy. Yeah, if you actually sleep deprive yourself a bit, you can re-energize yourself. It's becoming a bit trendy now. I think you're promoting it as well. But there's no doubt less sleep can give you more energy the next day. The problem is if you keep doing it, then in the end you might crash.
Yeah, absolutely not sustainable. So I guess there's something else that I'd love to explore with you, David, and that is actually the concept of tolerance, because is it possible that, we can still develop tolerance to these psychedelics just like with any other compounds?
Oh, yes. No, that's one of the good things, good and bad things about them in a way. But the good thing is that they're not addictive because if you take them every day, the tolerance develops so fast that you can't overcome it. Do you know who taught us that? No. The American Army. Yeah, so back in the 1950s, when people realized how powerful LSD was, and there was this great concern that the Russians were going to just spray LSD into every large reservoir in America, Americans were concerned that their troops were going to be poisoned on the battlefield by LSD. They thought, how can we stop this happening? Now, at the time, we didn't have an antidote. We do now. We have antagonists, but in those days, they didn't. So they looked to see what they could do, and they realized if they treated their soldiers with LSD for 2 or 3 days, by the fourth day, it wouldn't have any effect. So that's how we know quite a lot about the safety of LSD, because it's safe if you take it for a few days, but you also get this tolerance. Most people don't know that. Most people assume that these drugs are in Schedule 1 of the UN conventions and they're seen as very dangerous. People assume that they're actually addictive, but they're not. They're anti-addictive. There's studies now using psilocybin to treat tobacco addiction, to treat alcohol addiction. Actually, the most remarkable stuff goes back to the 1950s and 60s when the founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson, he was a great protagonist of LSD. He believed LSD was going to revolutionize the treatment of alcoholism. And he got six studies funded by the US government. And the effects were remarkable. One or two LSD trips were giving outcomes which are twice as good, or maybe three times as good as the best we've got today for alcoholism. But we haven't used them in 50 years because of this fear that these drugs are dangerous.
Well, those studies you just mentioned there, are they censored? Are they public? Like, where are they?
No, they are public. They have the two Norwegians a few years ago. Two Norwegians went out and got all the original data as well. I think it's in the public because they were funded by US government. So I think they have to be kept public. Those are the ones that did the reanalysis. Yeah. And that's something we're looking to do because alcoholism, I mean, I've estimated this. If these drugs were banned by America in 1967, so it was 50 years of banning. And I reckon 100 million people have died prematurely from alcohol in the last 50 years, probably more, but let's say 100 million. And even if LSD only helped 10%, that's 10 million lives saved. And you think, well, how many lives would have been saved from the ban? You know, how many people would have been deterred from using LSD from the ban, and how many lives would have been saved? I mean, probably none. But let's suppose there were some. You know, let's suppose it was, you know, suppose it was even a million. I mean, it's probably more like 10 or 20. But let's say, even if it was a million lives saved, you've still got 10 million lives lost. So the equation is so much in favor of keeping these available as medicines. I mean, it's outrageous that they were banned and not allowed to be medicines. It makes no sense at all. And it was clearly a political thing, and there's nothing to do. There's no health aspects of this at all.
When it comes to the application of anti-addictive compounds, like right now, if somebody's trying to give up either like alcohol or nicotine, what does Western medicine, how do they even approach that?
Well, that's quite a big question. Well, with nicotine, there are two things you can do. You can switch to vaping in some countries, which allow it. Not every country allows it. Or you can have nicotine patches, or you can have varenicline, which is like a nicotinic partial agonist. Or you can start with cold turkey, and you could go on Zyban, bupropion, to help you through that. But relapse rates are very high. I mean, you know, even the best treatment with varenicline, you know, most people use it, stay on it, because if they stop, they relapse. And that's why something like psilocybin, which kind of resets your whole attitude to smoking, the effects there are much more powerful. And Matt Johnson in Johns Hopkins showed, I think of his 18 subjects, 15 stopped smoking completely for a year. It was amazing. In fact, it was such a powerful effect that he's just got the first ever modern day grant since the banning. First grant in 50 years to study psilocybin for addiction. That's going to do a double blind study in relation to tobacco smoking. With alcohol, yeah, well, you got more choice with alcohol. There are anti-relapse drugs. There's one's called Ecamprosate, Campral in many countries. One's called Nalmefene. So Ecamprosate, you stay abstinent and it helps you stop craving. naltrexone is an anti-binging agent that reduces the your desire to binge, or the switch from drinking to binging. Some people use naltrexone for the same purpose. In some countries, Italy and in Austria, they use a drug called sodium oxybate, GHB, as a kind of way of stopping people craving alcohol, because it substitutes for alcohol and it's less harmful than alcohol if you use it sensibly. So those are the main options. Some people use disulfiram, so that if you drink, you throw up. But it's quite hard to persuade people to take that unless they've got a partner who's going to supervise it.
Interesting. Okay. There's one that you mentioned there. I was just thinking of some other aspects there. I guess there's a whole phenomenon as well. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on it. But I want to share my experience with a potent serotonin antagonist that I've personally used, cyproheptadine. I'm not sure if you're familiar with.
Yeah.
Well, when I administered that, like orally, like 2 milligrams, it would reduce, obviously lower my mood and make me feel pretty flat for a few days, but it has this profound rebound effect.
Interesting.
Many days later. And I'm just wondering, is there such a thing as feeling good upon withdrawal of a drug?
Oh, yes. Well, I say that. We published a paper in The Lancet, a letter in The Lancet. I can't remember that. It was about 1986, I think.
Wow.
No, maybe. Showing people who stop benzos, they often go into withdrawal, but they have facilitated orgasms. And that's because sometimes spontaneous orgasms. Isn't that similar to what you were describing with alcohol? That's probably because you get some kind of noradrenergic rebound. But this, what you're describing is interesting. It's hyperheptadine rebound. Now, that I've not come across. That's interesting. Have you come across other people experiencing it?
Yeah, well, I'm trying to build up a bit of a community. I've found numerous other individuals that also get that paradoxical rebound effect. And I've hypothesized various mechanisms, because I understand that it's a histamine antagonist, it's a D2 dopamine antagonist, it's a very dirty drug. It does appear to have like a very messy binding.
Yeah, I mean, I was assuming it might be a serotonin rebound, which would kind of, but it could be histamine rebound. That's the point, actually. Could do that. So the way you tested it, by the way, is you get one of these new, I don't know if you have them, but these new histamine presynaptic H3 antagonists, which promote histamine.
I have tried better histamine.
All right, then add it. Is that a similar experience?
It took a longer time. The thing is, the better histamine acutely was making me way more monkey brain, because it was the histamines is also.
Yes, that's right. It's a different experience. Okay, so it probably is a serotonin rebound then, I think. Yeah,
that's what I suspect is the... I'm sort of suspecting, because there's... I'm not sure if you... Because it's... everyone's trying to look for a cure to something known as post-SSRI sexual dysfunction, which is persistent sexual dysfunction following the use of SSRIs.
That's interesting, because I did write one of the very, I think I might write the first paper on cyproheptadine in sexual dysfunction on SSRIs.
Oh, wow.
Back in about 1924, I don't remember, but it was quite a long time ago. That was probably 1989, 1990. So we know that the sexual dysfunction on SSRIs is due to serotonin receptor stimulation, and the cyproheptadine blocks that. And so we can use cyproheptadine as a way of helping people regain normal function on SSRIs. But what you describe, I've not come across the post-SSRI syndrome before, but it is plausible, I suppose, given the fact that these drugs do produce some adaptive changes. What is interesting is we found when we're using psychedelics to treat depression in people who've been on SSRIs, we've got to get them off because they don't work. But even when you've got them off for a while, there seems to be some interference with the psychedelic effect. So it's possible that there is an enduring change in those receptors or those receptor couplings, which is what you're experiencing. Yeah, I didn't know. I haven't come across it clinically, but it's, I think that's plausible.
Yeah. I mean, it really is a million-dollar question at the moment, because there's an entire forum online called the PSSD forum, and there's thousands of different theories as to what they believe is contributing to it. And the biggest one at the moment is 5-HT1A desensitization, that 1A autoreceptor desensitization.
Well, that definitely happened. There's no doubt about that. Yeah.
So I guess maybe something else we can explore, David, is some of the...
By the way, on that point, buspirone is a 5-HT1A agonist. Now, that has been shown to help alleviate sexual dysfunction from SSRIs. So it might be worth trying in people with the post-SSRI syndrome. That would be... And it's a very easy, it's a perfectly safe drug to use.
Does it have a fit? I mean, I know a lot of people have actually responded very well to buspirone for PSSD. Does it have a clean binding activity? Do we know a lot about the drug itself? Or
it's pretty 1A selective, a little bit of D2, but I don't think that would explain it. I think it's the 1A, the 5-HT1A activity that would do it. Yeah. I mean, that's so people. Okay. Well, I think you're right. If buspirone remizes it, it's likely to be something to do with the 1A being desensitized. Turn it back on with buspirone.
Yeah, it's interesting. I'll definitely look into that. I might even discuss that with you a bit after the podcast at some stage, because it's all I can say is that it would be alleviating a lot of suffering for a lot of people out there, because they're
right. Yeah, good. I mean, there's another one called tandospirone, which is also, it's certainly sold in Japan. I don't know how easy it is to get elsewhere. That might be a bit cleaner. It's a more modern depression.
Is that a derivative? Is that a similar molecule to buspirone?
I think they're all azapirones. Yeah, I don't know. Actually, chemically, they're probably pretty similar, I would have thought.
Interesting. Yeah, we'll have to chat more about that. I guess something else, David. I guess with the I know you're quite big on the harm reduction strategies, things like that. So maybe you want to expand a little bit more on that term, harm reduction, and what you've looked into there.
Well, it seems to me that if you're going to try to, I'm a doctor. What's the purpose of medicine? The purpose of medicine is to reduce suffering, to reduce harm. Yeah, and I don't take a moral view of people who use drugs. I mean, how can you, when countries make billions allowing alcohol to be sold and taxed, and then they oppose the use of drugs like cannabis or magic mushrooms, which are much less harmful? I mean, the drug laws have always seemed to me completely, they're either political or morally based or some combination of the two. And they're exactly the wrong approach to dealing with the problems of drug harms. And if you want to reduce drug harms, then you do a harm reduction approach, because A, it's morally correct, and B, we know it works, whereas we know that stopping drug use doesn't work. Criminalizing drug users generally fails to work. In fact, we've got lots of examples of how prohibitionist policies actually make things much more dangerous for drug users and more harmful.
Mm. Yeah, I guess as part of the integration of some of these psychedelic therapies, what you prefaced before in regards to making sure everyone that's listening into this podcast to know that it needs to be done under clinical supervision, correct? This sort of application of these therapies.
Well, I think. Most psychedelics are not given under clinical supervision, obviously, because they're not medicines. I think at this stage, when they're being used as medicines, it's preferable, if you can, to be in a medical trial. So A, you're as a patient protected, and B, the data is collected in a useful way. Now, for many people, that's impossible. So what do I say to people? Well, I say, if we can't find a trial, then if you can find some sensible, established, well-run retreat that can give you access, then that might be helpful. But whatever you do, don't just go into the woods and pop your mushrooms yourself.
Yeah, that sounds like a bit of a risky venture that could lead you into climbing the trees.
Yeah, that's right. And whatever you do, make sure there's someone with you who isn't doing it the same. So you've got protection if things go wrong. But I mean, there are quite a lot of, I mean, certainly in Latin America now, there's you know, a vast number of shamanistic retreats people can go to, and they're all now, I mean, they're happening in the States, they're happening in Southeast Asia, you know, so it's not so difficult now to find places which you can trust. There aren't medical, but a close, yeah, at least do have skilled protagonists there who can pretend, you know, who will make sure that what you get is actually the right amount, because that's the biggest problem, knowing actually what you're getting.
Yeah, yeah. And there was one compound that we sort of skimmed upon, and that was, I'd love to just quickly touch on DMT as a endogenous molecule that's, you know, now used exogenously. So maybe do you want to explore a bit about,
yeah,
what do we know about DMT?
Well, DMT is dimethyltryptamine. I mean, it can be found in the body. The amounts in the body are very, very low, unfortunately. You know, there are people who believe, and maybe you are one of those, that it has some physiological effect in the body. It's hard to prove that. It's certainly, when you give a pharmacological dose intravenously, it has a very profound, rather immediate psychedelic effect, which is similar but more fast in onset to things like LSD and psilocybin. And now being developed by a couple of companies as possible treatments for depression. And it's quite interesting now, because so you've got this one end of the spectrum, you've got the short, sharp burst of psychedelic experience with DMT, and then you've got the other end, you've got things like psilocybin 4 to 6 hours, LSD 8 to 10 hours. It's going to be very interesting to see which of those different time courses produces the best outcomes. Undoubtedly, we will find out in the next few years, then.
It's really, really fascinating in terms of one of my actual close friends who, I think, I'm pretty sure he studied at Imperial College in London, Dr. Jack Alocca, recently, he's a PhD in sleep. He recently just underwent IV DMT therapy. So I think he's going to be sharing.
Oh, with us? Is he part of our study?
I believe he must have been. He was there a couple of weeks ago. Was it a few weeks ago?
That's the study we're doing. That's right. Yeah. Oh, okay. Good for him.
Wow.
Yes.
That was him. Yeah. He was posting some snippets of it on Instagram. So what was that study involving exactly?
This is the problem with DMT is how do you take it? So obviously DMT was discovered, psychoactive aspects of DMT were discovered by the indigenous peoples of the Amazon probably a few thousand years ago. And they worked out that if you brew up a cocktail of a plant which makes DMT and another plant which makes an enzyme inhibitor called harmaline, those two together, the harmaline prevents the breakdown of DMT in the liver and the gut. So you can drink the drink and get DMT in your brain. But if you just drink DMT, the liver breaks it down. And I see that's why psilocybin is so clever, because it bypasses the liver to some extent because it's got the phosphate group on it. Anyway, so if you've got pure DMT, which is what you kind of need really for Western medicine, then you can take it, you can smoke it, but you don't quite know how much you're getting. You can inject it. So our studies, we've done a couple of brain imaging studies with DMT, injecting it. And then about a year ago, a company came along and said, we're going to try to turn DMT into a medicine. Can you help us? And we said, well, sure, you know, we can work together on this as long as it's a co-development and you support us as well. So now we're doing a DMT infusion to see if we can get a longer effect. Because our imaging studies where we just gave a pulse, just give two injections of DMT, they lasted about 20 minutes. So now we're infusing DMT, which is what your friend probably had, to see if we can get if we can find what an acceptable, tolerable level of infusion is for a tolerable period, that would then potentially give us a more powerful antidepressant effect. And that's, you know, that study, we now know what is a safe dose in normal volunteers, and now we're moving to doing it in some patients.
Phenomenal. In terms of synthesis capacity, is it fairly difficult for researchers to synthesize, or is it, like pure DMT, I'd imagine, is it expensive to synthesize, or is it fairly easy?
I don't think it's difficult. It's a small molecule. And I don't know. Actually, I do not know the synthetic route, to be honest. But it can't be. It's not that difficult to methylate molecules. I don't. Good question. I don't know. I can't answer it, but I don't think it's going to be. It's not a complex molecule. No.
Yeah, well, it'll be interesting. I'll keep up to date with some of that research. You say MAPS will they be presenting that research, those research findings at all? Or
no, the company's called Small Pharma. MAPS is MDMA. MAPS is MDMA phase 3 will come out at the end of the year.
Yep.
We hope.
Cool. Okay. Well, I guess David, today's been an absolute pleasure. There's a lot we've sort of skimmed the surface on. I'd love to finish off by asking you, what area of research are you most excited to see, you know, more emphasis on in the future?
Well, I mean, I'm very interested to see how broadly we can use psychedelics. We've got an anorexia study going on. We're also collaborating with the University of Sydney to help them do a psilocybin anorexia study. But my other main, I'm particularly interested in the use of these drugs for addictions. That's where I'd really like to go. And then on the other side, of course, I've got my alcohol alternative, you know, my Alcarel, my Synthelol, which I'm trying to develop so that people can get the pleasures of drinking without, well, many fewer harms from it. So watch this space.
Phenomenal, phenomenal. Well, Professor David Nutt, thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you.
It's been a delight. Thank you as well. Cheers.
Thank you, everyone, for joining in to today's episode. For in-depth show notes and lessons learned, visit nofilter.media/boostyourbiology.
This has been a No Filter Media production.
Say what you want.